This is the Lou Rockwell Show.
It's great this morning to have as our guest Mr. Bruce Fine. Bruce is a constitutional attorney. He's founder of the American Freedom Agenda. He's a columnist. He's a speaker. And I must say, during the Bush administration especially, one of the heroic defenders of our civil liberties. And also, I've been extremely impressed, Bruce, by your calling for the impeachment of President George W. Bush. Why should this man be impeached?
Well, there are several high crimes and misdemeanors that have been perpetrated by Bush and then through his subordinates, including Vice President Dick Cheney. But, Lou, let me just identify three of the most egregious. But before I even get into the identification, let's explain to the audience what impeachment means. It's not a criminal punishment. It's not a revolution like guillotining, you know, Louis XVI or beheading Charles I. It's a statement by the Congress of the United States, supported by the American people, that power cannot be safely entrusted to a particular individual because experience shows it will be abused and threaten the republic. So with that background, let's get into what is it that President Bush has done that justifies impeachment. Number one, he has initiated war based upon false statements that he has made through both concealing information directly and through the vice president as to inflating the danger posed by Saddam Hussein to dupe or deceive Congress and authorizing him to invade Iraq. And what are the details? The details are that he did not disclose fully to Congress that evidence that contradicted his claim that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction, and that was a primary reason for invading Iraq. He also wasn't fully candid in exposing the frailty of the evidence indicating that Saddam was connected at the hip with al-Qaeda. Indeed, there's never been any evidence that was reliable that confirmed that idea. But then we also have most recently disclosed in a book that recounts an incident that Vice President Dick Cheney, operating on behalf of President Bush, had with then-House Majority Leader Richard Armey, a very staunch conservative. At the time, Lou, Mr. Armey was opposed to the invasion of Iraq. And in order to persuade him to flip his vote, Dick Cheney told two lies. One, that Saddam had miniaturized nuclear weapons, and two, that al-Qaeda would agree to be the delivery vehicles for those nuclear weapons because they were so enthusiastic for Saddam Hussein. Based upon those twin deceptions, Dick Armey switched his vote, gave cover to Democrats, who then, in conjunction with the Republicans, authorized the war that's now turned into a debacle. Now, the Founding Fathers were quite clear. James Iredell at the North Carolina ratification debates explained that if a president deceived Congress on a matter of war and peace into doing something that they would have rejected if they had the full facts, that is surely an impeachable offense. And what the president did with regard to duping the country to invade Iraq clearly falls into that category. And we also see the consequences, Lou. We've spent now, in combination with Iraq, Afghanistan, we're approaching now $1 trillion. The result has made Iran stronger, our archenemy questing for nuclear weapons stronger. And we've also inflicted on ourselves, well, we've made ourselves less safe. We've had self-inflicted another 9/11 plus one half. You know, 4,000 people, they've died for what? Do we see democracy around the corner in Iraq? I mean, that's a joke. And indeed, we have a president and candidates who claim they're all for victory in Iraq and are unable even to define it. Can you imagine that? A president or a candidate saying, I will have American men and women die for a goal that I don't even know how to define. I don't even know when I'll get there. You know, it said that the surge has succeeded. Well, how has it succeeded? What are the earmarks of success that are taking us closer to the, quote, victory that everyone claims they'll achieve in Iraq? But anyway, that shows that this impeachable offense of lying us into the Iraq war certainly has had very harmful consequences. The second impeachable offense is one that Mr. Cheney and Mr. Bush have openly confessed to. They have agreed that they spied on Americans through the National Security Agency for over 5 years without warrants in contradiction to the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. And that act has a penalty to it. It says it's a crime. If you target an American on American soil to gather foreign intelligence without a judge finding some probable cause to believe that the American is either implicated in terrorism or is a spy for a foreign government. And this is 5 years of felony crimes. There has never been any case made that if the president or vice president thought that the FISA law was deficient, They couldn't have gone to Congress and asked for it to be amended. Indeed, Lou, FISA has been amended since 9/11 over 10 times in response to administration requests. A president is obligated under the Constitution to take care that the laws be faithfully executed, not sabotaged. Faithfully executed, not sabotaged. And indeed, this was the foundation, for instance, of the impeachment articles voted against Richard Nixon by the House Judiciary Committee in 1974 that led to his resignation, namely that he was not executing laws, he was obstructing justice. Now, the third impeachable offense relates to his almost paranoia about any kind of oversight, any knowledge of what the government is doing that's disclosed to Congress or the American people. And it finds expression in the president's orders to two former White House aides, Harriet Myers, former White House counsel, Carl Rove, former White House political advisor, not even to appear before Congress in response to subpoenas investigating whether there may have been crimes committed through perjury, obstruction of justice by various Bush administration officials in trying to explain why nine U.S. attorneys who Bush himself had appointed had been abruptly removed despite no evidence that they had job performance problems. And the power of oversight, the power of investigation, is the heart of checks and balances. Sunshine is the best disinfectant. No president in history before Bush had ever claimed a right to muzzle someone from even appearing before a congressional committee. Indeed, if that were the case, that a president had such power, we could imagine Richard Nixon would have told John Dean, his former White Counsel, you can't go to the Senate Watergate Committee and tell them, you know, that I was offering bribes to the Watergate burglars. And even Nixon, who was not shy about claiming presidential powers, never thought he had authority to tell John Dean he couldn't even show up at a congressional hearing. So here we have the third impeachable offense, namely trying to obstruct and thwart any congressional oversight power by claiming plenary authority to refuse to disclose anything that the Congress wants to oversee. And this has caused, in my judgment, Lou, a total imbalance and distortion of the Constitution as envisioned by the Founding Fathers, whereby now virtually all power is concentrated in the executive, and Congress is basically reduced to an ink blot. You know, it passes earmarks, and that's about the extent of their influence. And it most recently finds expression even on the bailout legislation, where there's virtually no limits on how the executive branch can utilize this $750 billion of authority to favor friends, punish enemies, or do whatever else they think is politically expedient without any serious congressional oversight. So that's the sum and substance why we need to remove Cheney and Bush, and not to punish them, but to say they cannot be trusted to faithfully enforce the Constitution with all its equilibriums and checks and balances as envisioned by the Founding Fathers.
Bruce, you definitely need to be the prosecuting attorney in that action. I would say that they would stand very little chance before any kind of a real jury, even if maybe congressman.
I think the fact is, Lou, when these arguments that I've articulated have been made before congressional committees, there is no substantive defense. It's simply, oh, it's too late, it's partisan, you know, let's move on, 9/11, it doesn't matter, that sort of thing. But what I have described is totally irrebuttable. This is open and conceded, and no one who is serious about facts disputes what I've described as these three impeachable offenses.
Bruce, it's tough to know people's intentions, but why would somebody like Nancy Pelosi agree that impeachment is off the table, as she put it, and never to be considered? I mean, she's supposed to be, you would think, the partisan enemy of Bush. Why is this? Why when it was done to her guy, Bill Clinton, rightly or wrongly, why does she block it from happening to George Bush?
Well, it's because Nancy herself is implicated in a partial way. She was alerted early on with some of the other top leaders of Congress to the illegal surveillances, the waterboarding, which amounts to torture, and other violations that Bush was undertaking, and she chose to remain silent. In fact, her only public statement is, well, they told me not to tell anybody else, you know, as though the president can order any member of Congress to shut up. You know, hey, wait a minute, you're taking an oath to support and uphold the Constitution of the United States, that you're not a vassal. And so Pelosi is worried that if there were a full-blown impeachment hearing, she would be exposed as being complicit by silently, you know, accepting the legality, the correctness of what Bush was doing. And also, her calculations Lou, on this have not been constitutional calculations. They've been calculations based upon what she perceives as the best interest of the Democratic Party. And rightly or wrongly, I think it's wrong, but she believes the other way. She thinks that having an impeachment hearing would obstruct the ability to have Barack Obama elected in 2008, just in a week or so's time. And therefore, when it comes to choosing between the Constitution and the Democratic Party, she chooses the Democratic Party. Now, of course, there's nothing in the Constitution that justifies that hierarchy, but these days the Constitution is viewed as sort of a quaint instrument, to borrow from our unillustrious former Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez about the Geneva Convention anti-torture laws, but I think it's still a pretty good document, since it was written by perhaps the greatest collection of wisdom ever collected on the American continent in the last five centuries.
Bruce, here we have this, as you say, this unbelievable accumulation and centralization of power in the presidency. We have all the developments for executive power and spying and all the rest that's taken place under the Bush regime. How close are we to a police state and indeed to a elected dictatorship?
We're already there, Lou, when it comes to the theories of power. That is, the president has already claimed, and the Congress has acquiesced in two very alarming ideas. One, that the war against international terrorism is permanent. It will never end because the risk will never go to zero of another terrorist attack. And secondly, the idea that all of the world is a battlefield, an active battlefield where military weapons and military law can be imposed because al-Qaeda's goal is to kill us wherever they can find us. So that makes then civilian law subordinate to military law if the president chooses to impose it. But right now we're living under a theory of government that makes us vassals and serfs and the president lord of the manor, so to speak. Now, it's true that at present the president has not asserted martial law in the United States at his discretion, but he could any day on his theory of his powers. And that's a political calculation, not a legal calculation. And so we are close to moving towards a police state in the event that there becomes some other, and I cross my fingers, I don't want it to happen, some other incident like 9/11 that would cause the president to inflate fears again and to justify subordinating all of our civil rights and civil courts to military decrees. And we need to remember that that is quite a frightening proposition if we can think of what justice looks like at Guantanamo Bay for the detainees there. The most recent incident concerns 17 Uyghurs who have historically been opposed to the Chinese oppression over the Uyghur Muslims in northeast China. And they held 7 years, Lou, with not a crumb of evidence. They ever sought to kill an American, wanted to kill an American, did kill an American, but the Chinese government wanting them listed as terrorists for their own internal purposes, we acquiesced. And finally, when we got a court hearing 7 years later, the judge says, there's nothing that justifies their detention. And even after the court ruling, the president says, but only I can decide whether, even if they're being illegally detained, they can be released. So they should. He has the authority, according to Bush's idea, of keeping the products of his illegal detentions continuing to be detained. And this is what kind of justice we can expect for ourselves if we are subjected to the same kind of military justice. It's once been said that military justice is to justice what military music is to Beethoven. And, that's not to deride the Uniform Code of Universal of Military Justice. It's a good code, but it doesn't come near the fairness that we expect in any kind of civilized society.
Bruce, were you alarmed by the report in the Army Times that Bush has deployed a brigade from Iraq in the United States to do some sort of work, which he doesn't say, because the repeal of Posse Comitatus made that possible?
Yes, I am. We have a combat brigade, and it comes about, and again, Lou, I want to underscore, these are authorizations that the president hasn't necessarily arrogated. The Congress has given it away. So we got to remember there are two culprits here in this whole equation, the president and the Congress acquiescing. And here in a statute passed a couple of years ago, Congress repealed, by and large, the Posse Comitatus Act, a 100-year-old statute that basically says the military should not be involved in domestic law enforcement activities. And they expanded the exceptions to include, you know, Katrina's, natural disasters, drought, or any other circumstance that the president feels requires the use of the military, an open-ended exception that enables the president, anytime he thinks there's a crisis, it could even be fear created by a financial crisis, to say, I'm going to use the military to enforce the law. And we already know that there was at one time a Justice Department opinion saying, if the military knocks on your door, you have no Fourth Amendment rights to resist. So that's the kind of prospect we're looking at. You know, if any president wanted to use that combat brigade and say, oh, there's a real danger, a crisis, and therefore the military has to step in and substitute for our ordinary police and courts.
Maybe when they go out to arrest the short sellers.
Yeah, that's right. Well, or those, all of us, Lou, who are greedy. And I know we'll let the military and the greed, we won't have the religious police, we'll have their greed police. And they'll run around and arrest all of us who have smiles on our face or look like we are too much resembling a dollar bill or something.
Bruce Fine, now everybody listening to this can understand why you've been such a effective opponent against the abuses of the Bush administration. And thanks so much for coming on the show today.
Well, thank you for having me, Lou, and good luck.
You've been listening to The Lou Rockwell Show. Produced by LouRockwell.com, the best-read libertarian website in the world. If you'd like to advertise on this podcast or on the website, email advertise@LouRockwell.com. And thanks for listening.